I want to go ahead and continue reading there in chapter 10, picking up where Paul left off. There, verse 18, he says, "Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in the altar? Do I mean then that a sacrifice offered to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God. And I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons." Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than He? You know, as we continue our look here at the book of 1 Corinthians, let's go back and recap some of the things that Paul has touched on, and maybe some of the things that we'll even be getting to in the weeks to come. But there's several things going on here at the church at Corinth. And the problems in Corinth were multiple, but I believe if you look at them, you can see they were also interrelated. Various kinds of factions divided the church, including allegiance to different teachers. We see that in chapter 1 and verse 12. There were different socioeconomic strata. We see that in chapter 4 and verse 8, and we'll see that in a couple of weeks in chapter 11 as well. Sexual immorality was pervasive, including incest. We looked at that in chapter 5. And then prostitution, discussed in chapter 6, verses 15 and 16. Spiritual arrogance dominated the church as they exalted knowledge over love. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 3 dealt with that. And they asserted the superiority of their own spiritual gifts or status. We'll look at that in chapter 13 in just a few weeks, the first three verses. We looked at their misunderstanding of marriage there in chapter 7. In chapter 15, they denied the future bodily resurrection of the saints. And that enabled them to eat in pagan sanctuaries at idolatrous tables, which brings us here to chapter 10. We've been dealing with this idea of idols since about chapter 8. You know, the Apostle Paul was a man whose approach to life was totally reordered by his personal experience with the Lord. And if you look at his writings, if you see the different writings throughout the New Testament of Paul, you can see that. And his experience with the Lord, I think, fashioned that. The wisdom which he gained through this experience had enabled him to see through the pressures and the preferences that tend to take up so much of our time and attention. Everything that he did and every word that he wrote or spoke was done in the awareness of man's need of salvation. And I think we see that in Paul's writings. The gospel of Christ was the driving force in his life. That's something that we can gain from, something we can learn from, something that we sometimes put on the back burner. His writings are truly the operations manual for the soul, the rule book for life eternal, and the roadmap to heaven. And if you look at the New Testament, he wrote a big chunk of that. At least 13 of the books, possibly 14. But the two areas that he places focus upon here in the letter to the Christians in Corinth are the areas of immorality and also idolatry. Certainly these are two of the most potent weapons that the devil has in his arsenal. And if he can plant the seeds of either of them in the mind of a person, it eventually can destroy his spiritual effectiveness and productivity. And Paul is warning against that. He's writing to these new Christians. He's writing to these that are dealing and struggling with these different areas of immorality and idolatry. As with any one of his tactics, the devil always portrays them as innocent and attractive. And in no way does he want the extreme measures of despair, deterioration, or destruction they can cause to be seen. The Apostle Paul, with the full awareness of the devil's tactics, gave his time and effort to exposing them. And it was his desire that people would exercise the mental abilities that God had given them and have the good sense to resist the devil's efforts. In the text before us this morning, Paul singles out the Lord's Supper. And he holds it up as the deliberate plan of God for keeping his people focused on the very best concerns of life, the love, the grace, the faithfulness of God lie at the foundation of this memorial feast that we sometimes refer to as the Lord's Supper. When this subject is explored, it reveals the unlimited contribution of a caring Father who has supplied the means of redemption to a lost world. And at the Lord's Supper, with spiritual eyes, we see the gates of heaven opening and the gates of hell closing. We listen and hear the Savior who bled and died, but who now lives again, simply say, "Do this in remembrance of me." We partook in that just a few moments ago. We do that as we come together the first day of every week. A vital part, the focal part of our worship time together, is centered around the Lord's table. Paul touches on that here, and I think it's a good contrast. He says, how can you do both? How can you participate in one, the table of the Lord, and then the table of demons, as we looked at the last part of our text there this morning? So let's take just a moment this morning, and we want to look at this idea of the Lord's Supper, what it means to Christians, the significance. And you may think, well, I've heard this time and time again, yet we need a reminder of this. Paul is reminding the Corinthians, the Christians here, the importance of this, and that it must be the focal part. I think if we look at the historical roots of the Lord's Supper, when Jesus instituted the Last Supper, it was in context of the Passover feast. For a period of about 1,500 years, the people of God had been reminded of the importance of this great event. And the Passover was the time that the people who had descended from Abraham were given their freedom from the bondage of Egypt. And if you go back and look at Exodus chapter 12, we can kind of see the roots here. Verse 13 says, "When I see the blood, I will pass over you. This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days you're to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses. For whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through the seventh must be cut off from Israel." Reading down through verse 15 of Exodus chapter 12. You know, on the night before the Passover, each Jewish father would search his home and remove all traces of the leaven or yeast. And on the Passover day, the father would bring the male lamb, the one-year-old male lamb without any blemish, to the temple to be sacrificed. He would slaughter the animal and bring its blood to the priest, who in turn would dash it on the base of the altar of sacrifice. The parts of the animal that were to be burned were given to the priest, and then the remainder of the animal was taken home to be used as part of that Passover meal. During the evening meal, the cup of sanctification, which contained wine mixed with warm water, was passed around for each to partake of. The family would then eat the unleavened bread along with the portions of the lamb that had been prepared. Another cup, called the cup of explanation, was passed. And when the children asked about the Passover, the father would explain about the first Passover and how their people were set free. They would then sing a selection from the Psalms, pass around a cup called the cup of blessing, have a prayer for the meal, and then pass around the cup of consummation. They would again sing from Psalms and then close with a prayer. Passover was the first and greatest of the things the Jewish people were to share because it represented the first and most significant emancipation of the nation. It was a time of rejoicing, freedom, redemption, and commitment, and above all, it was a time of remembering. The Feast of the Passover had gone on for years and years as a time to remember that great emancipation. But you know, in the New Testament, the Passover continued to be treated as significant. And in fact, the life and work of Jesus was increasingly focused around the Passover. We can see this in the book of John. Here we have reference to three different times or three separate years in which Jesus and his disciples were involved in the Passover. In John chapter 2, they went up to Jerusalem when the Passover was to be observed, and it was on this occasion that he drove the money changers out of the temple. And then in John 6, near the time of the Passover, he fed the 5,000. Then in John 13, he and his disciples were in Jerusalem for the most astounding Passover of all time. And it was here that he announced something that was new and marvelous. He introduced the Lord's Last Supper. During this meal of the Passover, the unleavened bread was supposed to represent the hardships and deficiencies of Egyptian slavery. Now Jesus takes this unleavened bread, blesses it, and breaks it, and says these words, "Take, eat, this is my body." And then he took the cup and said these words, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." The contents of the cup had always been a reminder of the blood of the sacrificed lamb placed on the doorpost to protect the inhabitants from the certain death in Egypt. It would not be long until they would stand at the foot of the cross, these disciples who were there with Jesus at that time, and see the pierced body of Jesus as he hung, suspended by the nails through his hands and his feet. No doubt they would remember the words of Jesus as they saw his blood covering his face from the crown of thorns that had been placed and pierced upon his brow. It could be that they were saying to themselves, "This must be what he meant when he said, 'This is my body and this is my blood.'" They had known the historical significance of the unleavened bread and the blood of the Lamb, which reminded them of the freedom God had given their forefathers. Now they saw in the bread and the cup a much more profound reality. Christ, the Son of the living God, had redeemed us from sin, was going to usher us into the actual presence of God the Father. So as soon as the church was started, one of its major characteristics was to keep the feast in remembrance of our Lord Jesus Christ. Paul talks about this, and he mentions it several times, even here in Corinthians. One of the places is here in chapter 10. And Paul's letter to the Christians in Corinth are generally considered to be some of the earliest parts of the New Testament Scriptures to be actually written, dated somewhere in the mid-50s of the first century. And this would have been about the time of the Gospels and even before Acts would have been written. So there's some strong teaching in Corinthians about the Lord's Supper. And he presented Jesus as the Lamb of God, as having the central place in the church. Something that we do yet today. Isn't that a wonderful thing? It's been passed through those years, generation after generation, and yet it is meaningful today as it was in the day in which Paul wrote these letters. So we come together to Christians, as Christians, around that table. As we mentioned in chapter 5, Paul had to deal with the problem of immorality. What was happening in the church was so bad that even the sinners would not have practiced it. The man there in chapter 5, as we review a little bit, had taken his father's wife and was committing, they were committing fornication. It says there in verse 7, "Get rid of the old yeast that you may be a new batch without yeast, as you really are. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but with the bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth." Reading through verse 7 of chapter 5. Then in chapters 8 and 10, Paul deals with this issue of idolatry. And he makes it clear that an idol is nothing. There is no such God, however, that makes it clear that if we give ourselves to something other than Christ, we're giving ourselves to demons. We read about that just a moment ago. "No, but the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God, and I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons." Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than He, as we looked at just a few moments ago? You know, in the Lord's Supper, we give our total attention to the Lord. As we participated in that just a few moments ago, where was your mind? Where was your heart? What were you thinking? So often it's time and it's easy to drift away from where our focus should be. You know, in our world today, special occasions are often connected with food, are they not? And meals that are prepared. We have Thanksgiving, we have Christmas, we have anniversaries, we have birthday parties. Whenever there's a special meal, we can't wait to hear the words, "Come to the table. Come and be a part of this feast. Come and enjoy what's been prepared." And we have opportunity to do that each Sunday morning in such a special way. Now let's not confuse the two. This isn't a physical meal that we're coming together to eat. We do that on other occasions. This is a memorial that we come together to remember. But I think there are some very unique comparisons. And I'd like to close this morning by just listing a few of those. When we talk about coming to the table, the Lord's table, very much the same way we would come together to eat a meal, a physical meal. But maybe we don't even think about that when we gather around the Lord's table. Number one, before we sit down to a meal, we wash our hands, do we not? We clean our hands. Just good hygiene. It's good practice. You don't work in the garden or the garage and then come in and sit down and eat dinner without washing your hands. You wash up first. This is why the Bible tells us to examine our lives before coming to receive the Lord's Supper. We may see something that needs to be confessed or cleaned up. However, some people get so burdened by their sins that instead of asking for forgiveness, they figure they're too unworthy to participate. They may let the tray pass without partaking. If we think about that, none of us are worthy, are we? But if we've trusted Christ, we're eligible. He invites us and authorizes us to come to the table. Do we come as perfect individuals? No. But we should come as penitent people, trying to do better, trying to serve a God, trying our best to remember the sacrifice that was made and what that means to us. Paul told the Christians here in Corinth how important it was and reminded them there. Number two, before dining, we need a good appetite. And if you think about it, you don't come to a meal completely full, do you? What would happen if you were invited to someone's house for dinner and an hour before the meal, you got out a bag of chips, you drank a 2-liter of Coke and ate a box of Twinkies? You wouldn't be feeling like you're ready for that meal, would you? The same way it is. We can't mingle the two. You can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You can't have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. That's the second time we've looked at that verse. Psalm chapter 34 and verse 8 says, "Taste and see the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that takes refuge in Him." You know, compromise is good in certain areas of life. But God doesn't allow compromise in our Christian life. He doesn't say to have the table of demons during the week and then come and worship me on the first day and that's okay. He says, "I want you all week long." Sometimes we overlook that. Sometimes we forget that when we're out in the world during the week. We're in the world, but we don't have to be of the world. We're exposed to sin, but we can resist temptation. A third thing I think we can maybe compare to the two, when we're dining, we need time to enjoy the moment, do we not? I've been told that chairs in places like McDonald's and Burger King are designed so that the people won't get too comfortable. They won't stay there too long. It's fast food. They want you in, they want you out. They want the next person to have that seat so that they can go right on down the row. We often rush into things. Our culture is one that we don't take the time that we need to sometimes. When we partake in the Lord's Supper, we come to savor the moment, to linger, to reflect, to remember. Really, if you look at the time that's involved in coming together around the table as compared to the entire worship, it's just a very few minutes. We need to have that frame of mind throughout, that remembrance of that death, burial, and resurrection throughout. God expects that. We're not to rush through. A fourth thing that I think we can see as a comparison here, harmony at the meal table is important. You know that when you sit down as a family to eat. I heard about a family who got together for a meal, and before long, the table conversation had become very controversial. They had started talking about current events, but the discussion slipped then into political differences, and before the meal was over, they were very much at odds with one another. We need harmony, do we not? Same way when we come together. In fact, verse 17, we are one body. We partake of the one loaf. Conflict, tension, disharmony can all ruin a perfectly good meal. One thing we don't bring to the table is divisiveness. We should bring unity, love, compassion, honor, remembering the Lord who died for us, the Savior who died for us. That's the harmonizing effect of the table. That's what brings us together. A fifth thing we could say, we need to be grateful for this meal. That's when someone prepares us a meal to eat, to enjoy, to bless our physical body. We give them thanks for that. We need to be thankful for this as well. We need to appreciate the cost of this meal. Jesus prepared a meal for us that cost Him more than anyone could give, that being His own life. As much as anyone could give. You know, I think perhaps children maybe understand communion and the Lord's Supper sometimes better than adults with their childlike faith. You know, there's a big difference between being childish and being childlike. But a minister had asked a group of young children what they thought of communion and the Lord's Supper. Here were some of the responses. A 6-year-old said, "Communion is a part of God and God's life." A 10-year-old answered, "It reminds me of Jesus and that He died for us." A 5-year-old responded, "It makes me happy to remember." I like that one. It makes us happy to remember. And a 12-year-old stated, "It's the closest we can get to Jesus." And isn't that true? And a 6th thing, and finally on our list this morning, we also come to God's table with loyalty. We avoid the competition. We serve a jealous God. We see that in verse 22. Who will not be replaced with substitute. He demands our undivided loyalty. You know, we don't see overt pagan idol worship today, yet idolatry is still prevalent in our society. Jim touched on this in his Devo Wednesday night. Joe talked about it in the lesson last Sunday morning. Because trusting anything for what God alone provides, except what God alone provides, is idolatry. Eating at the Lord's table means communing with Christ and identifying with His death. Our partaking of communion indicates that we are undivided in our commitment to Christ and that He is our top priority. He is preeminent in our lives. Can we say that this morning? Can each and every one say that as we've come together this morning? That's why we're here. That's the number one reason. I know many of you have made an effort to be here this morning. Thank you for doing that. We've got visitors this morning who are traveling, or traveling through maybe on this holiday weekend. Thank you for being here. It shows the priorities in your life. I appreciate your presence this morning. God appreciates your presence. But just being here, is that all it takes? No, there's so much more. And we realize that. Christ hopes that you choose His table. It is best by far. It's where you enjoy His grace, His fellowship. It's where He is the gracious host. Guilt and struggles are not a reason to run from His table, but a reason to run to the table. Many have thought that we have to be nearly perfect during the week to come to God's table. But the table is a work of God. He expects you to try. He expects you to do your best. He doesn't expect perfection. Sin is a part of this life. Sin is a part of this world. Yet where's your heart this morning? The table was designed for Christians. Those to remember the death, burial, and resurrection. Those that have put on Christ through baptism. And again, we don't want to confuse the two. This is a memorial feast. When we come together the first day of the week, we do this in remembrance of me. Very short phrase, but so important. As Christians, do we realize that importance? I think it helps to get periodic reminders as Paul's reminding the Corinthians here. There may be some in the audience this morning who haven't yet put on Christ through baptism, haven't taken that initial step, haven't met that blood of Christ yet. What a wonderful opportunity to do that. We have the baptistry that's completely full and ready. Nothing mystical about those waters, but we know it's the blood of Christ. The blood that was shed for each and every one. The blood that we remember when we come together on the first day of the week. If you're subject to that invitation, won't you come as together we stand and sing?